Hi there, everybody. My name is Dave Benson Phillips, and you're listening to Three in a Bedroom. This is an experimental podcast.
Greetings, dear listener. Jimmy Willis here, and a big, warm welcome to the first ever episode of Three in a Bedroom. Now, we are recording this show now because I believe, Dave, we are losing you for 3 months because you are going to be performing in Panto. What are you up to this year?
Panto season is going to be Aladdin this particular year. And it's the first time I'm about to play a very serious role. I play the genie of the lamp. That's right.
So you look like a genie.
I look more like Buddha at the moment. I'm kind of sort of fat and brown looking. But when the actual season goes off, I'll be covered in gold, wearing a big sort of, you know, genie style hat, and I've got to squeeze in a lamp at least twice a day, which is going to be a bag of fun. And they've also told me that I'm the guy who comes out on the stage. If you've ever been to a panto, they normally have something called a pyro, or which is short for pyrotechnic. And of course it goes flash, and there's a puff of smoke, and then you leap out from the wings as though you've appeared by magic, and you go, "Fala, I am the genie of the lamp. What is thy wish, O master?"
I've been scanning through the morning's newspapers, and the good news is Prince Philip seems to have made a full recovery after his illness. He's not been very well.
He's just sick of going out, really, and being on public display. Yeah. He goes out twice a year, doesn't he? And he had all that Jubilee stuff, and he's like, "Oh, I'm bored. I'm just going to sign myself off."
Come on, think about it. The man's nearly 90, right? He stood there on a barge, right? He hadn't been for a wee. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I mean, not been for anybody's bladder after 4 hours of... Yeah, we're watching a load of water, rain, and people on boats, right? And yeah, that's a lot of water. Yeah. And you've got to hold on to
it. He looked happier than the Queen, quite honestly, on that boat. He was like, "Oh, I don't know why I'm waving, because nobody can see me.
I'm at liberty to tell you this, but I was supposed to have taken part in the flotilla. I was supposed to be able to take a part of the flotilla, and it was me and several other black performers, and we were supposed to be on a boat. But the only problem was we did look like a bunch of Somali pirates. So in the end, they thought we shouldn't take part because it just looked like, "Hello, yes, we're going to kidnap the Queen."
Can you imagine?
You know, it just looked all right. There's 12 of us on this barge going, "Yeah!" Waving things, it just looked wrong.
Well, I've got some things that Charmaine can help me with, because you're quite a fashionable type sort of person. Oh, I'd like to think you're trendy. You're one of my trendier friends. No offence, Dave. But no, I've got some new items of clothing over the last couple of weeks. Yeah. The local sports shop in Hove was shutting down, and I went and got some trainers. You know, everything was half price, closing down. Yeah. Respectable-looking businessmen all turned into, like, wild animals looking for food. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's on their hands and knees with trainers and cheap
Primark on a Saturday morning.
Socks and boxer shorts. They're just all in boxes, and it was horrific. But anyway, I got these. Yeah. Now, they're Usain Bolt trainers.
Everyone looked really blankly at you. Yeah, but are you actually running those trainers?
Well, I don't think they were actually his, but they're his make. But the laces keep coming undone. So I've tweeted Usain Bolt. I said, I did. It's just true. He's not replied. I said, "Usain Bolt, I've got some of your trainers and the laces keep coming undone. Do you have this problem when you're running with them?" And I was hoping, I thought it'd be quite funny and he might get back to me, but he hasn't.
Well, do you know what? I can't wait to find out.
I think we ought to go on a personal vendetta now and just keep tweeting him now.
Yeah,
what,
maybe.
What is it with your shoelaces? Yeah, is it because they came from Poundland?
No, it wasn't Poundland. But they were half price, but they're sort of 60 quid trainers normally. You would have thought Usain Bolt running trainers would be all right. But anyway, there we go. That's my latest.
Are they comfy?
Yeah, they're lovely.
Are they?
I think I actually walk faster in them than I have otherwise. No, I do. I do think that. Are you a fashion man, Dave?
I'd like to think I was. I am a fashion man, but I think it was. The emphasis on was. I now dress for practicality and comfort. I mean, the outfit that I'm wearing at the moment, just to give you an idea.
He's naked.
Well, yeah. If you're going to call a show Three in a Bedroom, at least one of us ought to be that way inclined. But yeah, I mean, literally, it's just, for me, black practical trousers. I've got on a hoodie top, and I've got a fleece on the top of that. I'm basically ready for indoors and outdoors. Yeah. It's just like a ready for anything outfit. That's what it's like for me.
Well, I looked on your Facebook status this morning, and you're modelling agency. You've got a modelling agent or something.
Yeah, I have. Okay. I have. It was well, after years of being told that I have a face unique for radio, this agency phoned me up, and it was one of those weird things, because I'm so used to people sort of contacting my internet and phoning me up and giving me wind-ups and abusive calls. So imagine my surprise when this agency turned around and said, you have a really interesting face, we like what you've done over the years, would you like to be represented? And I went, you what? And they... Oh, hello.
Hang on the phone.
Yeah, that's me. Oh, no, it's just me phone kicking off. It's my timetable on my phone. I have a daily timetable, a bit like school.
Are you going to be modelling for CNA now? Mark's
well, I'm hoping.
Randomly in a direction.
Do you know what? I did that when I was a young lad. I did all of that stuff a long time ago. But the thing that they're saying at the moment is because they have this deficit on sort of black actors, black male actors. And they said, well, you know, you're middle-aged. I've never been called that before, despite the fact I'm 47. Oh, no, it's great to be middle-aged. I never thought I'd ever become middle-aged. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't have sort of black, Caribbean, Afro-looking blokes who can be, you know, middle-aged. And I thought, well, yeah, if you can get me loads of work, then do it. But that was the shocking thing today. Yeah. I made the announcement because I actually thought it was a wind-up. I honestly was waiting for somebody to phone up and say, Dave, we were just messing with you.
So Lenny Henry will now be fighting for jobs.
Oh, yeah. Me and Len, yeah. Lenny in the one corner, me in the other. Only one conclusion.
On.
Fight!
It's all right. Well, there was, because you were telling me a story. We met for coffee off Rivers last week to talk about the show, and you said your son was watching the TV. And he said it was, what did he say?
It was the advert for Premier Inn. Other hostelries are available. And of course there's Lenny's dulcet tones, because he's gone actor now, he's all actor now. And of course he comes in on the final shot and says, you know, you're never alone with a Premier Inn or whatever it is. And Benjamin, 2.5, you know, been with him ever since he was born, looks to the telly. He's used to seeing Daddy on the telly every now and again, points to Lenny Henry and says, Daddy.
You know, I have that problem a lot, actually, because actually people think I'm like Sharon Watts from EastEnders, so I don't know what's worse.
Well, it's funny because you were at a charity gig on Saturday, which I came, and I had the very important role of drawing the raffle, because it's, you know, when you've made it, Dave, don't you? Any work's work, isn't it? But anyway, but you were behind a bar, and I said you look like Sharon.
Oh, come on, Sharon, if you're going to do that.
I did at the top of my voice, but it's my pub now, get out.
Oh, but you weren't actually serving behind the bar, were you? No, I don't know what you were doing behind there. You're robbing the place.
No, I was fiddling with the sound system. That's what we call it in the business, fiddling.
Because it was then again, you look up and go, what can I get you, love?
So, and I often get heckled. There's one comedy night that I do that I get a regular at, and they're always going, "Here, Sharon, tell us a joke." And I'm like, "Oh God!" And they go, "Where's Phil tonight?" I'm like, "Oh God!" Can we just move on? Do you know what I mean? The audience is like staring at me as if I'm like, what?
"Do you know what you ought to do? Do you know what you ought to do? If you can get hold of Letitia Dean, who of course plays Sharon, and say, Sharon, you know, and he says the whole Sharon bit, and you just go behind the curtain, and then out." Pops the teacher's teeth and says, what?
Oh, I wonder. Yeah. Doof, 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 doof.
Yeah, and just have a look at this geezer's face as he just goes,
Well, she's a bit tied up with old EastEnders now, isn't she, again?
Oh, yeah.
She's got her career back. At least one of us has.
Well, no, she never lost it. It was one of those ones where, you know, if you're associated with a soap or something really big, sometimes it takes a long time for, you know, society and everything to remember that you're an actual person and not just that character. It must be so difficult. It's like a long time ago, there was an actor in EastEnders. He was one of the Carpenter family, the first black family who was in EastEnders. A guy called Paul J. Medford. who, and of course he played the son, and it was years before he could get anything or be taken seriously. And there was a musical at the time in the West End called Five Guys Named Mo.
Oh yeah.
And he was one of the Moes who was in this show, and he said that did it for him. That was the great thing because all of a sudden, yeah, because all of a sudden he became an actor and was known for things other than EastEnders. For some people, it's a great thing to be in a long-running soap.
Totally.
And for other people, it becomes like the millstone round their neck. I wish to have that millstone round my neck.
Oh, I would just like to have the career.
Stop it, Char.
It's Monday. I'm feeling a bit sorry for myself.
You are, aren't you, a bit today? You're having a bit of a blue.
I woke up this morning. I won't even repeat what I said this morning, but the first words out of my mouth were unbroadcastable, quite honestly, just because it was Monday and it was like the beginning of the month, all the bills are due. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, no, I can't bear it. But anyway, I've done that and it's all very
lovely
now, being in the bedroom with two boys. Yeah. Something to look forward to.
Handsome boys.
Oh, sorry, I missed that bit.
Yeah.
Handsome boys in the bedroom.
Available as far as I'm concerned.
Right, we're talking about EastEnders there. TV. Now, Dave, you've been on the TV a lot. Do you watch much TV?
I do now because I'm not on the TV as much. I'm a terrible telephile. I love television. As a kid growing up, I mean, everybody's growing up and circumstances were very different. Everybody has, you know, different things on childhood. And in my case, my parents, you know, they both came over from Barbados. There was not a lot of money around and they had to work a lot of jobs. So a lot of the time we were left at home. And I was the firstborn over here. I'm one of five, but the other two grew up in Barbados, my older brother and sister. But I grew up over here, and we had at the time an old black and white valve telly, the valves took a long time to warm up, so you'd hear the sound of television, and then in the evening there would be this eerie glow coming as the actual vision was coming through, of characters on the screen. And I can remember my earliest memories were listening to the music of the Lone Ranger while standing in my cot. And the other, so I must have been what, seven? And the other one was Coronation Street. So I grew up with those, and my parents used to watch a lot of television. My father was very anti-television. My mother watched the soaps, and of course, we as children watched everything in between. And yeah, I loved television. It was it became a family member, as far as I'm concerned.
What do you watch now, like EastEnders or X Factor?
Do you know what? I'm not a big lover of the soaps.
No, are you?
No, I'm not. I kind of grew up with it because my mum would sit there and say, nobody talk, Crossroads is on. And that was it. And nobody could talk for half an hour. And then, yeah, Coronation Street was on. And then, you know, when EastEnders came out, that was getting another thing that we watched. I'll tell you how bad my mother was, right? We're talking about, she used to watch Emmerdale religiously in the days when it was called Emmerdale Farm. She must have been like one of, what, 20 people watching it? Now it's big business.
Yeah.
What was the other one?
One of 20.
but what was the other one? Take the High Road,
the Scottish one.
Yeah.
She's now in Emmerdale Farm. One of the girls that used to be in that is now in Emmerdale.
Yeah.
As a grown-up.
So my mother used to watch all the soaps. And, you know, when it's like X Factor, Mrs. Phillips watches those religiously. I mean, literally, we plan our year around what programmes are on.
I think seasonally, the seasons need to be rechanged now, because I think winter ought to be like X Factor now, because that's what we have over winter. Yeah. Then spring should be Britain's Got Talent. Then summer is Big Brother. So we just change the seasons to reality TV shows, because that's how we plan our lives around.
Yes, the leaves are falling on the ground. Must be time for X Factor.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because see, farmers just looking at, instead of listening to the BBC sort of, weather report. Oh, yeah, Simon Cowell's out again. You know what that means, right?
Time to get the cows in. Simon Cowell's out.
I'm actually into the X Factor again this year. I haven't watched it for a few years since sort of Simon Cowell left it, but I'm quite into it this year.
Ryland. I actually promised myself last night that if Ryland got voted off, because he is entertainment, isn't he? He is. He can't really sing, but you do want to watch him. He's like a car crash.
Everyone wants to know what he's going to do, and I think that's
a bit like the Jedwoods.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When they kept coming out.
I think these reality shows need someone like that, because he's in the papers every day, isn't he?
Watch it. If he got voted out yesterday, I wasn't going to watch it again, because it would be boring. There's none of that, like, they just well, they're just average singers, aren't they? There's nothing amazing about what they do. But anyway, he stayed in, didn't he, last night?
Yeah, I've only just watched it this morning. Oh, dear. Oh, hello, mum.
It's a comedian looking for work. Hold the line, please. Oh, hang on, we'll put him on. Hello. I'm actually in the middle of a broadcast at the moment. You're live on our little podcast. Yeah. Hang on, let me put you on speakerphone.
Hello, what's the subject of the podcast?
Well, then we haven't really got one, really.
All right. Hello.
Hello.
This is Kevin Dewsbury, comedian extraordinaire.
Oh. And hello.
Dave, you're here with Dave Benson Phillips and Jimmy Willis.
Never heard of it.
me and Dave are sat here looking quite rejected.
Yeah, we haven't heard of you either.
Now, anyone that's listened to my breakfast show over the last couple of years, really, Charmaine's been coming in every Wednesday morning, and we have been trying to find her a celebrity boyfriend. How are we getting on with this, Charmaine?
I know, well, I'm always on the lookout for a future ex-husband, so...
Johnny Depp, what happened to him?
Johnny Depp, do you know what I mean? I think he's gone into hiding. We don't hear about him much in the news, and it's probably because I've been stalking him. It's just like, he wishes he never actually made it public that he'd split up with Vanessa Paradis, because he's like, oh no, Charmaine's on the warpath now to find me. And especially when we spoke to you last, and Dave, and you said that you had met him before, and I'm like, put a word in for me. So now Johnny Depp has gone undercover. The next one, potentially... Tom Cruise.
You don't like him. He's too short for you.
He's rich enough. He's just too short.
Listen, I set Cuban heels. You won't know.
I have read the book Dianetics, so potentially I could become a Scientologist.
Oh my god!
But I don't know. I'm getting fussier with age. You know.
Have you got any of these religions, Dave? These Scientology?
Yeah. Last week I tried Scientology. This week, Christian fundamentalism. might be a bit of Judaism next week. Yeah. I'm not sure. No, religion's an interesting thing. As a kid, I was brought up in the Church of England faith, and all the schools I went to, bar my high school, were all Church of England. So, I was learned. Yeah, one of the first things I learned to read once I got past the Janet and John books was the Bible, and other things. And as I got older, religion became less important. I actually did want to go into the clergy, Did you?
Well, that's
you and me, right? We're just not suitable for that, are we?
And then we end up in a bedroom together. Yeah. Ooh.
I don't know. There's a lot of things that I found out about history with certain monks, and it was actually really quite awful. A friend of mine was part of a dig. And there were on the grounds, there used to be a monastery and a nunnery, and they found a interconnecting tunnel. And they found something really quite bizarre. And in the middle of this interconnecting tunnel, there was a sort of an antechamber, which had been quite undiscovered for quite some time. And they reckoned that this is quite prevalent with a lot of the faiths of the time, back in the days when they had a lot of monks and a lot of nuns. And they found that they used to meet in certain cases, and some nuns were pregnant, and they used to get rid of said babies in these rooms.
You heard it here first.
Oh, yeah, I mean, just think aspects about religion. I mean, religion is a great thing, and then human beings get involved. Look, that's quite controversial. Look at that. See, I've just turned it all serious. I mean, I love the idea of religion. I've always liked the subject of religion. And myself, although I was brought up in the faith, I found myself practicing it a lot less. Maybe it's an age thing, because you find that people who grow up in a faith lose it for a while whilst they get on with their lives and do all the hedonistic things that human beings do. And then as they sort of are faced with their own mortality, i.e. the onset of age, old age, they start thinking, oh, maybe I should go to church, or something happens.
I always find, like this morning, I pray to God when I know I've got to pay my rent. Please let there be enough money in my account.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the only time I seem to find religion is at the beginning of the month.
I was brought up in a little village, and it was very much all very religious, but I never really just got into the whole idea, really. Just didn't quite... I couldn't understand. It just didn't sound very believable. Which,
well, the thing is, was your family religious at all?
Not really. I mean, I've never been christened. Yeah. But it's funny you're saying as you get older, you start worrying. So I was thinking of getting christened just to cover all bases, just in case. But no, I don't know, really. It's just they really try and preach it at school. And I felt it a little bit too much. I think I don't know, really. I'm just not sure.
I went to a Church of England school and it was... I went to Sunday school and look where I am today.
Innocent.
Oh dear. Yeah, no, I wouldn't even... It didn't do me any good, did it? but no, I mean, I think religion is each to... every it's an individual thing to everybody, isn't it? And I think there is something bigger out there, and I think I'm more spiritual than religious. And it's nice to think that, you know, if you put something out to the universe... and you're a good person and all that kind of thing, then you might... I don't necessarily think there's a great big guy with a white beard looking over us going, right, you're going to hell now because you swore. You know, I think that's a bit crazy. Yeah. But I do think there's something spiritual in all of us. And now it's getting towards Christmas. People don't actually remember the real meaning of Christmas. It's just all about adverts and chocolate and presents and can I have an iPad? And I am like that, quite honestly. Christmas. Yeah. Me. But then the whole idea of religion is actually forgotten.
Yeah,
and that's what it's actually meant to be for, isn't it? Remembering baby Jesus, or baby cheeses in some cases.
Yes. Talking of Christmas, Dave, I was actually interested because we were saying at the start you're going off to do your panto, and I was talking to someone about it. I said, Dave's off to go panto, and they said, "Oh, that must be really hard work because I've never done it." But is it like two shows a day, all through November, all through December, 7 days a week?
In this particular case, this particular show that I'm doing, I've got sort of the rest of November just to learn how to do the part, and then the whole of December and early January is when I get to do the performings, the two shows a day. And it depends on what kind of venue you're in, because some places do two shows a day. There might not even be enough people to come and see two shows in a day, so they just might only warrant one performance, and then you might have two at the weekend, which is kind of almost like West End kind of style, because you just do your sort of like once an evening, and then you've got the whole day just to shop and do Christmas things. But in this particular case, we've got two shows to do a day. It's going to be fairly intense. The other thing that we also do now is that we do a lot of school shows as well. Oh. And those are the shows that start at 10 o'clock in the morning, as opposed to the usual sort of 2:30 in the afternoon when you think, well, that's actually quite human to get up and do a show for that time. And then you've got an evening show at 7 o'clock, say. So, of course, we've got to be lively for 10 in the morning. Ah, kids! Yeah. Oh, God! That's the way that schools like it.
The one thing I did wonder, I'm guessing you do have to do it on Christmas Eve and Boxing Day, so you only get Christmas Day off?
Yeah.
Because you've got a young family, you've got a young boy and stuff. Do they come up with you, or...?
They might do on certain occasions. They'll come up for sort of Christmas Day, but, I mean, normally what happens is that Mrs. Phillips will hover around the house right up until the moment where she needs to go, and then we all get together as a unit.
Yeah.
But I know Mrs. Phillips, she's sometimes happy about it, but she's not.
Because you must sort of miss Christmas, really, in a little way.
Well, to tell you the truth, Jimmy, I've much as I like Christmas, I've never been a real sort of fan of it. I mean, I love the whole sort of spiritual and remembering why Christmas is Christmas is Christmas. But then, of course, you know, as an entertainer, if you're not doing anything at Christmas, you must be a bit rubbish. And that's the one thing that I always remember.
Shuts down. Comedy kind of shuts down a little bit for my side at Christmas.
Really?
I have got shows sort of November, December and January, but you've got to think, especially when I run a lot of the comedy shows as well, you've got to think, actually, people won't be around because it's Christmas, and they might be going to pantomime, or they're going to go be with friends. So from my point of view as a comedian, the dynamic does change over the festive season, whereas yours sort of gets busier again.
Well, because it's children, so it's one of those things. I'm actually quite surprised that you said that, because I thought there would have been like comedians doing like some sort of alternative Christmas thing.
Maybe that's where I'm going wrong. I should do an alternative Christmas show.
Well, let's put it this way, right? For the first time a couple of years ago, instead of doing panto, I've done panto now for what? It's got to be about a good 25 odd years worth.
And it was two.
Yeah. that's right, baby. Yeah, you know. Anyway, the fact of the matter was that we were offered a Christmas alternative. Now, I'd never heard earlier. There's shows like Mistletoe and Wine that was out for years, and Christmas nativity type shows, or just shows that went the spirit of Christmas. So they were more not religious, but more seasonal sort of thing. So imagine my surprise when I get asked by an orchestra, would you like to put together a Christmas kind of show for loads of children, loads of adults in Liverpool? Thank you very much. So there's me, there's Mrs. Phillips dressed up as a teddy bear. We've got a reindeer sitting outside the concert hall. And yeah, 2,500 people coming in, and we're getting them to sing Christmas songs and stuff. And it was fab. And you know, there wasn't an, oh no, it isn't, oh yes, it is. There was none of that.
I've been dying to do that ever since you started talking about books.
And all that business, and it was just amazing. From that point of view, it was amazing. I mean, you know, it was for me probably one of the few times where I thought, "Ooh, this Christmas, they could have something in this," and I loved it. But you know, it's a great thing, and I love to work over Christmas because it means as an entertainer, I'm busy. And of course, when I was a lot younger, my family sort of relationship and dynamic was not great, and I used to find myself doing things on Christmas anyway. I had often, and oh, I can't believe I'm going to admit this, but I used to help out in the soup kitchens in London.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on Christmas Day, and I used to sort So if I was doing a panto in London, instead of sort of spending my time with Mrs. Phillips, where she was my girlfriend, as it were, I used to sort of say, "Well, you have a good time with your rallies. Thanks, everybody."
And I'd like to do that.
I'd go off, and with the embankment mission, I'd just go off and cook a whole heap of turkeys, along with a rest of some other people who've given up their team. And yeah, we used to do it in shifts. So people would come in from their families and spend a couple of hours giving out food and presents. And of course, I was there all day, so it was really nice. I don't.
Oh yes, I was.
Boom, 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 boom. You just wait for my mouth to stop, weren't you?
Charmaine, have you ever done panto over Christmas?
I did pantomime twice.
Yes.
That was enough for me.
Was it?
It's not for everybody, though. It's one of those things. I mean, I was kind of lucky. And, you know, I mean, there's some panto companies that I've worked with, and actors and actresses and dancers that I've worked with, and I think, oh, I shall keep in contact with them. And then there are other shows where I've worked upon where if I saw them again, it would be too soon. Because it's one of those things where, you know, you get a load of strangers, you lump them together. It's like Big Brother, but with a job thrown in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, you're in this hothouse for, what, 6 to 8 weeks, and you've got, you know, these shows and routines to get on with, and all of a sudden everything clicks, and it all becomes very insular, very incestuous, very family like. You know, somebody coughs, when somebody person coughs, the other person at the other end says, "Oh, excuse me," because that's how close you get. But it's, yeah, if you get the right show and the right panto and everything, it is a beautiful thing to be in.
Is it a dying thing, panto, or is it still busy?
Do you know what?
Have you noticed?
When I first started doing panto, I mean, when I was a kid and I watched panto, it was still quite magic. And then for some reason through the 80s, as entertainment became more alternative and more edgy, panto was seen as a dying thing and a naffness. Just to give you an idea of how it was considered, well-known camp comic and raconteur Julian Clary,
yeah.
His standard line for anybody he thought was rubbish or not very good, he would say to them, "And when are you appearing in panto?" And that was his line. That was his stock line, despite the fact now he does panto. But I met him. That was the first thing that came out of my gob, and it was just after that. No, it was Handbags at Dawn. Yeah. It was just, but it was really interesting, and it went for a real sort of dying thing, and now it's come back very strongly. People do love it. And
I think it's because, I'll tell you what, I think it's not just, you know, Julian Clary saying, "Oh, when's your career over?" implying kind of thing. But now, because you've got so many reality TV people, like from Big Brother, you've got The X Factor, you've got Britain's Got Talent, whatever. I bet you Pudsey the dog's got pantomime this year.
Possibly.
Betcha, in Hollywood, no doubt. But I bet he's doing pantomime. And that's where they're getting all the people from a lot these days, and that's why it's making it more popular again.
And what you said there, the other thing, of course, is at the end of the day, and it's a terrible thing to say because it's a fantastic tradition, and it was, you know, born out of, you know, very wealthy Edwardian families who used to put on shows for their staff. Mm. That's how it all came about. And the thing is, people have now discovered if you do it in the right way, you can make a lot of money. It's a, yeah, and you can do. I mean, sometimes, I mean, there was one star I never got to see. It was George Takei, who, of course, is Mr. Sulu from Star Trek. Who
Friends of his on Facebook.
Oh, wow. Charmaine, I'm impressed. But, yeah, but George Takei, was, you know, he came out and was a genie. And, you know, greetings, live long and prosper and all of that business. And they lapped it up. They couldn't get enough. So, of course, you know, you have...
He's got a massive following. Actually, I think I deleted him off Facebook thinking about it because he got on my nerves. He posted so much. Like, haven't you got a job? Get pantomime.
The man, I mean, he's legendary.
He's
that
legend.
Man.
He's legendary. He did actually put very funny posts up, which I probably got the hump because they were funnier than mine.
Well, you didn't sit there and do that normal thing that most comedians do,
steal.
Which is I get that a lot on my Twitter page. I wrote the odd line every now and again, and I'd hear it coming out of the mouth of someone. You must get that as well, Char, where you think of a line, you put it up there, and of course it comes out of the mouth of some comic, and you're thinking, you got that off me.
Yeah. Actually, I don't like to use other people's stuff at all. Obviously, you've got to be unique and everything, and people don't want you to repeat other people's jokes. But I did. I seem to be doing charity gigs these days. It was a charity gig, and I actually threw in. It was relevant to the moment, but I did throw in one of Russell Howard's jokes, and I thought no one's going to know. And I did it, and I admit I did use his joke to my advantage, and he got a laugh. But afterwards, I'm getting loads of text messages going, stick to your own material. I'm like, oh my God, see? So, moral of that story, never nick anyone's material, because even if you think no one's going to know, someone out there knows.
Do you know what? I've had gags of mine turn up on television, and when I've turned round and said, it's mine, they've turned around and said, yeah, but you do children's, and nobody thinks you're funny anyway.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it was just, I'll tell you, a long time ago, I mean, if you the ugly spectre of racism, I remember writing a load of material that which ended up on the television. But the writing team, one of the members of the writing team had brought me in when I was a young fledgling wannabe gag writer and sat me down and gave me a half an hour lecture on why black people weren't funny.
Oh my God.
And just said, thank you for your stuff. And then about 4 months later on the BBC radio programme, I heard my gags go out one after the other. It was. It wasn't the BBC. It was just the independent gag house. But I kid you not, it was just that whole thing of, you know, and yeah, that was one of the things that I wanted to do and why I needed to get on television big time.
Prove a point.
Well, not only to prove a point, but to turn around and just say, you know, at some point when they give me an award, you guys better be sitting in the room because you know you're gonna know about this. Did you hear about what was it, Fiona Phillips?
No.
Right. Presenter Fiona Phillips, similar sort of thing. Went to a school, I think, somewhere, and she was asked as an old girl to come back and regale about her time at the school, so as to inspire the young students. And of course, what Fiona Phillips said was basically, I didn't have a very good time there, and everybody ripped it out of me, and the teachers weren't good. And she stood up and kind of delivered it both barrels, and I'd like to be in that position one day.
That would be amazing, because I would love to go back to school and actually say, you were no help to me whatsoever. You may have taught me how to read and write. Actually, no, my mum did that before I went to school, so you were no help whatsoever. And actually, when it got to I remember having a huge argument at school because it came to they asked you what you wanted to do for work experience. Yep. And I wanted to go and work in a theatre because I wanted to be an actress and all that malarkey. Mm-hmm. I want to work in experience. Well, we've got a lovely job going as a secretary in an office local. No, I don't think you're quite listening to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Don't want to be a secretary. You may want every other girl in the world to be one, but I don't. But have you thought about being a secretary? Yes, and the answer's no. And I want to work in a theatre. Well, ironically enough, after me, I was a diva back then having a tantrum. They did end up getting me work experience at the Yvonne Arno Theatre with none other than Judi Dench.
Oh, at least they listened and did. That's fab.
But that was a bit, I'm not going to bitch about fellow artists, but that was an experience. She almost changed my mind to be a secretary.
Oh, come on, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, come on, come on. 50 years of James Bond, she's in it. Dish girl, dish.
Okay, this was a long, well, I'll say a long time ago, I'm not that old. Yeah. But when I went and did my work experience, and it was a show called The Diary of Mr. and Mrs. Nobody, and it was with Michael Williams, her late husband, and Judi Dench, and I'm just there, just getting in the way of everybody, you know, this young student going, oh, what do I do? I don't know if I should say, she did have a really bad attitude. This is before she was a dame. Damehood might have changed her, I don't know. But prior to that, she was really horrible to me. Really horrible. And she used to bitch at Michael, her husband, like you wouldn't believe. They were the arguments they had backstage, and he just stood there like a little told off schoolboy all the time. And it was quite horrifying to see, you know, as a really young girl with this mad woman screaming at her husband in rehearsals. But then when we did the show, and obviously I was sort of in the wings watching it at night time, she would freeze a lot and forget her lines. So it makes me go, why is everyone raving about you? Well, I mean, she might have improved. She might have had a few classes since then. But when I was working with Judi Dench, one of the props fell over, I remember, it was the opening of the second act after the interval, which totally threw her off. And she just stood there. Just frozen, and Michael Williams had to pick it up and go, oh, and take over from her because she didn't have a clue what she was doing. And so that was my little showbiz talk. But I'm sure you're lovely now, Dame Judi Dench, and it would be a pleasure to work with you on a Bond film. After slagging you off.
Wow, Charmaine, I don't think that's going to work, that little bit again. I don't think that's going to help.
Well, listen, this stranger things have happened. You know, I've wound up working with people that, you know, I thought, oh, you hideous people. And then, of course, they meet me years later and they're very lovely. And then I say, well, the first time you and I met, you were absolutely hideous to me. And I love regaling it to them. You can see them.
Dame Judi Dench.
Oh, it's one of those things. Life is interesting like that. But,
I thought going back to school, because I have got, when I was at school, I was horrific. Because I'm really badly dyslexic. Wasn't diagnosed till I was 23. So all through school, everyone just thought I was an idiot. But not an absolute idiot, and it was horrific. I still wake up some mornings now, and if I've got to get up and do something I don't want to do, I really still think to this day, oh, at least I haven't got to go to school. Honestly, it's really bad. It sounds terrible. But everyone just, because I was, and my mum actually became a teacher because I had such a hard time at school, so she thought she could try and help people. And I went back to college when I was about 21, 22, because I left school with nothing, absolute nothing. And I started...
Change there, then.
Well, no. But I started... I'd done two lessons with this English teacher, and she said, oh, yeah, I think you're dyslexic. And she sent me to a very simple test. A couple of days, oh, yeah, this is the problem. I thought, well, how did I go through the whole of school and not get diagnosed whatsoever?
You know what, Jimmy? You and I are very similar. For me, I'm not dyslexic, but everything else that they found out about me was diagnosed when I was, 17. Yeah. So school was school was well and truly behind. But... it's one of those things, if you're tarred with a brush, it sometimes takes somebody who doesn't know you all that well, who has experience of that with other children. If you think about it, this teacher has obviously been around dyslexic kids and had seen it and just went, no, there's nothing stupid about you. It's all up there. The lights are on. It's just you don't know which room they're in.
That's a good way to put it.
So it's just a case of, look, come with me. Do you know what this is? Can you read that? Yeah. When you see the word bed, what do you see?
Yeah.
It's all of that sort of thing. It's really interesting because a friend of mine used to teach a lot of dyslexic children. Mm. And a young lady that I used to date years ago was incredibly dyslexic. Again, found it, diagnosed it. She's got a degree. Massive, great job. But you're talking about sometimes if you don't know, and it's very simple to look at somebody who's not quite grasping something and say, you're stupid. And of course, it's the crowd after that. It's the kids in the class. It's the teachers. That's the thing.
People tell you enough that you're stupid, then you'll believe it eventually, when you're not actually stupid. You just need a little help in the right way, you know, direction.
Like you, I still have, every now and again, because Mrs. Phillips pulls me up on it, I still find myself saying, I'm slow. I'm not very bright, and I still hear myself doing it. I can remember as a kid just being told, I'm not very bright, I'm not very bright, I'm not very bright, and then and believing it and then quoting it myself. And that, yeah, you must know what that is. It's a horror.
But there's nothing worse when you're trying really hard, and then that's the worst thing, and they say, well, you're not trying hard enough, and you think, well, I can't try, I'm trying harder than everyone else. But they, and after, when you get to about 10 or 11 years old, you just think, well, what's the bloody point? But as easy as that, isn't it? Because you don't, it's just, it's horrible.
I remember one of my lecturers at college.
So she went to college.
Well, hey, hang on, we got a posh one.
No. It was, well, I went to college, yeah, but I did performing arts. So that, people go, oh, that's the easy option. Well, no, it isn't.
There's nothing easy about that.
No, voice projection, there's nothing difficult about that. No, but my drama lecturer, who ironically has just become my friend on Facebook after all these years again, he used to, because I wanted to be one of the showgirls. I'd tap dance my way around the stage. I wanted it all singing, all dancing. And he wanted to do Brecht and Stanislavski, and every theatre should have a meaning, and you need to leave that theatre of having learnt somebody, and the world is an awful place. And I'm like, well, I just want to do the splits. And he hated me, and I'm really surprised, actually. He's just taken me. Ooh, I'm in the bedroom with three men, and you can see where I'm going. Has just accepted my friend request on Facebook, because I just wanted to see what he was doing, because he used to have a professional theatre company as well that always used to go up to Edinburgh. And he would actually look at his students, and this is what I really hated about it, was he would look at us. We were all trainee students, you know, trainee actors, darling. And we didn't really know anything about anything. And he would actually make us feel like that as well, going, I've got a professional theatre company, rah, 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 and you're all just a load of old rubbish. You know nothing. And it's like, that's not really the attitude to have when you're a teacher. And my mum, bless her, because I used to go home so disheartened after college and go, he thinks we're all rubbish. And she'd go, well, Mum, she'd go, my mum would say, well, those who can, and those who can't teach. Mm. So let's see where he is with his career. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Mm. So I'm hoping he's going to see all my statuses now on Facebook and see how fabulous, successful, in my head that I am. And what's he doing? Oh, yeah, still at a college.
Well, yeah, but then again, you do get some cracking teachers. I mean, some of the teachers that taught me for stuff were very happy teaching and very good at it. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you find those who can and you find those that do. And then, you know, just, oh, God, who used to do lots of acting teaching that I've read about? Guy called, oh, you wouldn't have heard of him, William H. Macy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because he teaches.
Isn't he a comedian?
Well, he does do funny bits, but he does a lot of acting. He's known for his acting. Right. He did things like Boogie Nights, and he was in that. He's the guy with the moustache. He's the guy with the moustache. If you've seen it, yeah, the one who shoots himself.
Right.
Oh, I love that film.
William H. Macy, lovely actor, lovely actor. And he's one of those guys who used to teach. And again, it was one of those, oh, who's the other one? Very famous. It was Italian-American actor, Ray Strasberg. I want to say Strasberg. He got, just to show you, he taught loads of people how to act in the New York Actor Studio.
Strasberg.
Is it Lee Strasberg?
Yeah.
So, well, thank you very much. Oh, in that case, Shah knows the story. Yeah. You probably don't, Jimmy.
I don't know.
So I'm going to tell you.
You go for it.
So this guy taught loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of actors. Loads of actors have gone through. Robert De Niro, this guy Al Pacino, this guy, he churned them out. Anybody who wanted to get on in film went to this man, Mr. Strasberg. And somebody, very cheekily, and I think it might have been even Francis Ford Coppola, who of course made the Godfather films, decided to call him out and said, look, you train all these people, you've never set foot on a stage, you've never gone and done a film.
What do you know?
What do you know? Prove your point. And so Mr. Strasberg said, well, all right, stick me in the film and see what we'll do. Okay, so Mr. Strasberg goes in the film. He does the one film. He does the one role. He does it. He gets on his first go at film an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor during The Godfather. So, yeah, And he just said, up yours. Yeah, wow. I can do and I teach. And you think, yeah, all right, yeah, whatever. That's okay.
Godfather's got to be one of the biggest films. Everyone says it's one of the most popular films with men of all time, certainly.
Do you know, I would have said that, personally speaking, for me, yeah, Godfather, all three of the films were just great. Do you know my favourite film is? Shawshank, man.
Shawshank Redemption.
Shawshank Redemption.
I love Shawshank Redemption.
It's a very manly film, though, isn't it, Shawshank? I don't get it. It's 3 hours of my life wasted. It feels like I'm in prison watching it. I can't bear it.
I like it. I also like Forrest Gump as well. I
really do you like really?
Forrest Gump? Yeah, I think it's underrated.
Oh, did I say that out loud? Oh, dear. but everybody else, everybody's got a favourite film. But I mean, I've got to admit, for me, Shawshank followed by The Green Mile. What does that say about
that? Was
him?
Just in my head.
You've got a theme going of prisons.
I don't know.
He just died, that guy.
Yeah, the big guy.
Really sad. I did like the little mouse. That was it. That was the only bit that touched
me. I've always wanted to know how big he actually was, because I don't know. Didn't make him look bigger in films. I just wondered how big he actually was.
6'5" or something.
Well, I'm 6'4".
Oh, he was bigger than you. 6'10" then.
he was a big. I know he's a big guy. I mean, I've got to admit, I loved him in Armageddon.
Oh yeah,
Armageddon was just
these
that.
These are all real boys' films. I'm like,
but I mean, he didn't do very many sort of what you would call sort of female friendly films. I mean, he did Talladega Nights, you know, where he was the race manager who got himself stabbed with a fork. I mean, but you know. But yeah, he's what a guy. I mean, I still find myself every now and again when nobody's looking, I stand on the bed in my house and I sort of adopt that Michael Clark Duncan pose when he's in his underpants during Armageddon. He says, "Pork rind this, baby." And I'm thinking, you know, but oh, geezer. What a geezer. Are you looking at my socks?
No, I'm not looking at your socks. I'm looking at, it's like a friendship bracelet people wear around their wrist, but you've got one on your leg and I keep looking. I want to ask, what is it? What is that on your foot?
Yeah, we have that in our family. Young lads in our family reach an age where they're supposed to be men. They have to do a manly thing, and then we get that slap round us. And at the age of about 12 and a half, when I was a young lad in Barbados, I spent a couple of years out there because the school basically said, it's either that or Borstal. And I wouldn't mind, but it was a fit up.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just not that kind. I don't break windows, you know. Mm.
I don't break wind. I'm like, what?
No, I break wind. Oh no, trust me. If I feel one brewing, I'm gonna take that microphone off you. Okay, but we have to do something fairly manly. In my case, I had to basically capture and kill and basically and stuff a chicken.
I thought you were going to say a tiger. I thought you were going to say a tiger or something. I was saying manly.
Listen, it's Barbados. If we had tigers in Barbados, right, there wouldn't be much of a population in Barbados. Because we'd all be busy going, what that? And then we'd all be gone.
So you killed and scuffed a chicken. Yeah, and then
Listen, I'll tell you, running around after that chicken, man, that chicken made me work for it.
But there's two in the garden here.
No, really.
No, they're ducks.
Oh. I mean, I'm no good with animals.
They've got wings.
Yeah, nice one, shot. So you sort of go up to it, you know, you get it, you either wring its neck, but my granny gave me a machete. Mm. And of course, I'm a South London boy. Yeah. I don't know that.
Quite nicely with machete in London, quite honestly.
Yeah. Machete, I knew what that was. Yeah. You show it to people and they run. All right. That was the only thing that the chicken had in common with everybody else in South London. I was like, machete, and the chicken went, and kind of legged it. And so I'm chasing it around. And of course, you know, as a kid, you know, right up until that point, I used to think to myself, well, it's a chicken. They come in plastic and you get them from the supermarket. I didn't equate one with the other. Yeah. You know, you see it running around and, you know, and doing the old neck.
Very sanitised, isn't it, in the supermarket?
Oh, yeah. So your granny gives you a machete and says, there, the chicken. Off you go. And I'm
PCB
and it was pretty full on, and I got it, and it took me a few hours, and it was just like, you know, it was like the beginning of Casino Royale, you know. It was just not going well. And I think it just gave up.
It jumped off the bridge again.
It just went, I've had enough. I'm just gonna lay down. But yeah, but that's my manhood thing. That's my strap round.
My left leg. Maybe if I need to get one.
Well, do you know what it is?
Puberty,
it's a real sort of puberty sort of rites of passage thing, because I don't know if any other cultures have that. I know with Jewish people they have bar mitzvahs, and Sikhism they have an age where boys, particularly boys, go into manhood, because it seems a very important thing. And yet in this sort of this British culture that we have, when I've asked people this whole question about what do you do as a rite of passage, some people see it as like your American prom style dance at school. Some people see it as when they get their driving license.
I'm still waiting for my driving license.
Oh, stop
license
it. Stop it. Another rite of passage may be, and this was prevalent where I used to work in Staffordshire, where it was traditional for the father to take their young son for their first legal alcoholic drink. And I say that like that, where, you know, it was a real important thing. There was one family that I used to work with, and they all had tankards behind the bar. I don't know if you've ever been to a pub like that.
But the oldie, oldie country pubs.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and they all had tankards, and it was like, you know, granddad who used to drink in the corner, his tankard's there, but he's, you know, he's not been alive for some time, but his tankard is still there. And, you know, there's a space behind the bar, and you've got your dad's tankard, and you've got your mother's little sherry glass, and then you've got, you know, your tankard with your name engraved. And, you know, it's a big thing. You walk in, you say, can I have a pint of bitter or a pint of lager? Or, thank you very much. And then all of a sudden, the tank gets filled, and that's your rite of passage done. Oh. You know, yeah, some people are like that. Me, go out there, kill a chicken, and provide it for your family.
Has that been on there since the age of 12, then?
Well, no, it's been different versions of, because being leather, of course, it rubs, it chafes, it falls apart, it disintegrates. So every now and again, you do have to replace it. But around my left leg, there is a dark mark.
Oh.
Ever since I was a 13-year-old lad, where there's this sort of this black tide mark of various leathers that have rubbed along my ankle sort of for years. So you'd be able to look down, and if you know I'm from Barbados, or if you know that my family are from Barbados, you say, oh yeah, I know that sort of thing. But again, but they reckon that it's probably something to do with slavery as well, that some of us had shackles and other things, and so it's kind of interesting. I'm still looking into that side of it, but you know, from an immediate family tradition, this is.
Do you ever go back to Barbados now?
We're not going to afford it. Yes, and thanks to the recession, I haven't been able to afford it. But that said, I mean, as soon as Benjamin's old enough, I mean, we're sort of teaching him about Barbados, but he's only 2.5, so it's not a lot.
Hot beaches,
hot beaches, and it's full of crabs, and it'd be like, you know. But then
again, tweets.
Oh my goodness!
I'm from Swindon. It's not quite as exotic, is it?
No, Swindon's great.
I've got treats.
Okay, and what are the sweetie treats, please? Can you describe?
After eights. Well, they're not like proper stereotypical after eights. They're not the thin type, but they're more like munchy style.
Oh. Right then.
So I thought, you know, we could have a little energy boost in bed.
When I was a young, when I was a young aspiring actor, thank you very much, by the way. When I was a young aspiring actor, I used to work in a shop in Covent Garden, and this shop used to sell all sorts of knickknacks that you never wanted, but when you saw them, you really needed them. And they used to have these after eight mints alternatives called after sex mints.
Wicked.
Which, of course, you were supposed to hand out after the deed is done. But yeah.
Give me a bag.
Well, there you go.
I see we've got instruments as well again.
Yeah, I bought a guitar along.
Speaking of after sex, you've got
an instrument, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What, are you going to perform, are you?
Well, I was going to, but I thought we're having such a great time chatting.
We could have a song to finish off with.
Yeah.
Another pun there.
I'm sure there's other ways. If you really want me to pull out the guitar.
Yeah. Is it a big one?
Oh, it's huge, girl. Oh, it's huge. You're going to like it. I'm just a little bit concerned that the 21st of December, apparently the world's going to end, according to a particular calendar.
That's a nice way to end the podcast.
Well, yeah.
I'll see you next month.
Well, hence why we're in this bedroom at the moment, because I thought, well, you know, if anything does happen, my two favourite people on the planet, let's just get it on. And
let's get it on.
And if we're here the day after, it's just going to look a bit embarrassing.
You've not brought Mrs. Phillips, have you?
No, that's all right.
That's a bit funny, but if we all survive December the 21st, it will be like the fourth time that I've survived the ending of the world. So that'll be quite an achievement, wouldn't it? Because it's like four or five times in my lifetime that the world's meant to have ended. So, but apparently the Mayan calendar ends on the 21st of December, probably because they just ran out of time and didn't have time to finish another one. But
we ran out of paper.
I think might have been the deal back then. They ran out of rock and chisels. But yeah, wouldn't it be mad?
When was it all the computers? Was it when it turned to 2000?
The year 2000, and they reckoned that planes were going to drop out.
Nothing happened.
Do you know what? Do you know what I did? I was so scared. I bought myself, and I've still got it now. I bought myself an automatic watch, so that powers itself on movement.
Yeah.
Because I was so worried that it was all going to go all Mad Max, and I remember putting fuel in my vehicle and stocking up on extra cans of fuel and water. I used to have in those days. I used to have a red sort of passion wagon, big red Nissan truck. And this thing was packed to the right. The only thing I didn't have was a bow and arrow. I mean, I had everything else. I was like a weekend warrior. And I was convinced, I was in Darlington at the time, and I was convinced that the end of the world was going to happen because technology wasn't ready for it.
Dave, do you want to play a song for us to end the show?
Do I
want to
sing a song? I do.
Do you do a lot of music stuff, Dave?
I do when I'm allowed to. And funnily enough, since the recession's happened, it's one of the easiest things to get into a theatre and out of a theatre is somebody with a guitar or a musical instrument. So I found myself doing lots of songs. And I do. I'm a sort of frustrated drummer, so I sort of do a lot of strumming. This is a six-string guitar. It's a folk guitar, and I'm going to sing a song. And it's a really silly. And it's taught to me by a friend of mine. And it's a well-known song called "Side by Side," which starts with "Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money." But this one is a bit alternative. We got married on a Sunday. Then we party till Monday, and when the guests were all gone, we were alone, side by side. She said, "Let's go to bed." Then that's when I nearly dropped dead, when her teeth and her hair she left on a chair, side by side. I was broken hearted when her glass I did fall. First an arm, then a leg, she leant them against the wall. I was so broken hearted, half my wife had departed. So I slept on the chair, 'cause there was more of her there, side by side. So it's a bit of a humorous song there. Sorry. Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
Is that big
enough?
Yes. I'm not.
No.
It's not very often that I'm speechless, to be quite honest with you.
Well, no, it's all right. I mean, I just like to sit here and just sort of do things and do tunes. And I've brought along a big old gig book. So I do lots of songs. But yeah, I found myself yesterday, I was at Children in Need doing one of their films, and I found myself singing, "Party rockers in the house tonight, everybody's gonna have a good time." And just doing stuff like that. And it was great. Walked into a club, yeah, this is what I see. All these lovely people and they're staring at me. I got a party in my pants and I ain't afraid to show it, show it, show it, show it.
Woo! Jimmy Willis, music producer.
And on that note, you better wrap this up.
Thank you ever so much, ladies and gentlemen, for checking out this show. Big thank you to lovely Charmaine Davis.
It's my pleasure.
And also thanks to the lovely Mr. Jimmy Willis.
Thank you, thank you.